Hello and welcome to Non-Breaking Space, which you can find online at nonbreakingspace.tv. Non-Breaking Space is a show where we'll seek out the best, brightest, and smartest folks on the web and talk to them about how and why they do what they do. Your hosts are Christopher Schmidt and Dave McFarlane, two web designers, authors, and trainers who have a passion for sharing knowledge about the web. I'm Chris from Canada, a web designer and podcaster. Christopher and Dave have invited along to help push the record button and keep everyone on track here on Non-Breaking Space. Our guest for this episode is Jennifer Robbins. Jennifer has been a web designer since 1993. She designed the web's first commercial site, O'Reilly's Global Network Navigator. A graduate of the University of Notre Dame, Robbins is the author of Web Design in a Nutshell, Learning Web Design, and HTML and XHTML Pocket Reference. She has also written corporate identity style guides for clients such as Harcourt Publishing, AmericanExpress.com, and Orange Imagineering. Since 2000, Jennifer has lived in Providence, Rhode Island, where she has worked as a freelance designer, teacher, lecturer, and consultant through her company, Little Chair Incorporated. Jennifer has taught at Johnson & Wales University and at the Massachusetts College of Art, and is now a product designer for O'Reilly Media. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Christopher and Dave and their conversation with Jennifer.
Thanks, Chris. Hey, Dave, how's it going?
Oh, good. The holidays here. The kids are home from school, and I'm forgetting that I had to do a podcast. But I also finished my documentary that I told you about that I was making, and had a premiere on the big screen here in Portland, and it went well. It was super fun. Totally not related to the web, but I had a great time.
Cool. Yeah, as you had to cut your time short in Hawaii for the Zen Control conference.
Yeah, I had to get home and finish editing this film. So, it turned out great.
Yeah, how'd it go? Like,
it was great. It was part of a workshop of documentary, novice documentary filmmakers. So there were like 10 films. They were like 10 minutes long each. And we had, a packed theater here in Portland. And it was great. Super fun thing to do.
Cool. Can people find the video online?
I have it up on YouTube and Vimeo, so I could post a link and you could check it out. It's totally not related to the web, though. It's about my wife writing a novel and being part of National Novel Writing Month, which just ended last November or this November.
Yeah. And she's done this before, right? So times, right? So
yeah, this is the fourth time she did it.
So it's awesome. So like you're in your family, you've both written books then, pretty much. So
correct. Yeah,
that's awesome.
Writers, definitely. Cool. How are you doing?
Doing okay. I'm just recovering from putting on In Control Honolulu and CSS Dev Conf Hawaii, and so it's been kind of like a blurry week this week, trying to get caught up on everything, and then get slammed right with the holidays. But I'm happy to be here, and having to talk to you guys again. Awesome with you and Chris Enns and you for the podcast. And I'm also happy to have our guest for today, Jennifer.
Yeah.
Hi there.
Hey.
Hi, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, we're honored that you're here. This is great. Cool. The first question we always ask is like, how did you get involved with the web? And since you started when it pretty much started, I guess you were there at the beginning, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And it's just a case of, right place at the right time. I had been working as a book designer at Little Brown, designing book interiors for law books and medical books. And then I went over to O'Reilly in 92 and was designing books for O'Reilly. And at that time, Dale Dougherty came into the office and said, hey, there's this new part of the internet, and it's called the World Wide Web, and it has graphics, so I think we need a designer. So my boss, Edie Friedman, at the time, who is actually my boss today at O'Reilly, and she was taking a short leave of absence and said, here, Jen will be great at this. And she like put me in the group that was looking at the at this new web product, because Dale had this idea like, oh man, we could do like a magazine type thing where we talk about the emerging web, and it would be sponsored. We could have ads, like a magazine would have ads. And that was May of 1993. At the time, I think there was only, Mosaic that ran on Unix. So I had to run Mac X on my Mac to run Mosaic on my Mac. And that was short-lived. There was a Mac version not long after that, but had to jump through some hoops in the beginning. But I was there, there were 150 websites And then we published GNN, and part of one of the little sections was the NCSA What's New, where we listed all the new websites that week. And it would be, you know, like, hey, there are 10 new websites, you know. And most of them weren't very useful, but there was interesting some of the people who came on very early on. I remember like LL Bean was on one of the first selling stuff, wow. You know, one of the first commercial websites. There was a thing that was called Hot, Hot, Hot that sold hot sauce.
Yes, I remember that one, yeah.
that was really early.
That was a cool site for that. Oh, man, that was awesome. I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, Hotwired came along pretty soon after us. But I want to set the record straight. We were out there first. So wow. when you see all those, you know, reports, those journalists writing, you know, the Hotwired was first, I'm here to tell you we were publishing 6 months before they came on the scene. So, you know. Just setting it straight. Yeah. But no, it was interesting. I'm actually going to give an Ignite talk on the early days of the web. I've been digging through all my old archives, what I can find, and I found specs for how to design a page for GNN. Mm-hmm. And it's like the GNN homepage is 515 pixels wide.
Oh.
And you'll have to use, and the only graphic file format you can use is a GIF 89A. And to make that, you'll need this tool called GIF Converter.
Yes.
Wow.
So yeah, it was just so cool to like go back and see what we used to have to do. I think it was Photoshop 2 or Photoshop 3 that we used, and it didn't have any of the tools we needed to create. There was a tool called GIF Transparency to make this transparent. So much of the stuff I had forgotten about, but
yeah. And there was a if you want to make animated GIFs, you had to like get this other tool for animating GIFs as well. And so it was just like if you want to compress it one way or like there's like because today when we're talking about like adaptive images for responsive web design, and people tell me like, oh, we can't deal with a new image format because you know browsers aren't ready for it, blah blah blah. I'm like, they weren't there in the beginning times when Photoshop wasn't even ready. For the web, right? You know, you had to have all these plugins if you were lucky, you know, by the time you had to wait a couple of years for plugins for Photoshop, you know, and then you had to wait. It took Adobe a while to get it baked into Photoshop.
Yeah, and if you put a JPEG, if you wanted to use a JPEG, it would launch an external graphic viewer. Like you couldn't embed a JPEG in a web page. So, for the beginning, I was just doing a lot of like, you know, I did mostly the graphics, so a lot of icons. There's someone else doing the HTML writing in the beginning. And then once we switched, we started doing a magazine, like a more strict magazine style called Web Review. Right. And there I started doing like my own mockups in HTML and giving those to production because they were getting a little more fancy. But in the beginning, you know, since O'Reilly was part of or at least members of O'Reilly were working with the W3C like very, very early on, we were very strict about the way we used the HTML markup. So we, you know, all of our pages started with an H1 followed by an H2 and everything was used, you know, perfectly, you know, semantically.
Right.
And then other publications would come around. I don't know if it was hot, you know, like Hotwired and I don't know when Suck started. But they used like BR to make cool little columns and like with space around everything because at the time there were no style sheets. There was no way to put space around stuff.
Right.
So, and they were just using, you know, skipping H1s and 2s because they were so big and clunky and just doing whatever they wanted. Mm-hmm. And it looked so much prettier, like, you know, from a graphic design standpoint, it's like, oh man, it looks so much nicer. And we weren't allowed to use any Netscape extensions, so no background color changing. So our, you know, GNN and Web Review, well, I think we used some background in Web Review.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and there was the hack, too, where like, sorry to interrupt, but if you had multiple background colors,
it would
animate that.
It would fade in or fade out. But so we had, you know, just the gray backgrounds with these giant H1s. And it was, as a graphic designer, it was a little painful. You know, I did the best I could. We couldn't use, you know, the align attribute. So all of our graphics had a big space next to them. You know, like you couldn't wrap text around any of the graphics. So it was very clunky. I was very envious of the other publications are just diving right in on all the Netscape extensions, but we kept it pure. And And it's funny how it's all come around again back to, you know, using it, using HTML, you know, purely semantically again.
Yeah, I think it's, but like even then, I mean, it's. I always point to this when I talk, because it's like that, you know, Opera developer, like they did a whole survey and they found out, like, after surveying hundreds of thousands of websites, only 5% of those websites were actually valid. They actually write semantic code. So, like, I mean, that's like, I think it was like 400,000 to 200,000 websites they looked at. And so only, you know, so if you actually do valid markup, you're like cream of the crop.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an issue. But now, like, looking to the present, like, you just wrapped up a learning web design book, right?
Yes, it's the fourth edition of that book.
Yeah, so learning web design, comma, fourth edition.
Yes.
So awesome. So what did, you know, and, you know, Dave's written, how many books have you written, Dave?
I have three books, but, you know, multiple editions. I'm like, I don't know, the eighth edition of my Dreamweaver book. I just finished the third edition of my CSS book. So I've, you know, been writing for a long time.
So like,
David, I do the same thing. I have written three books over and over again.
Over and over and over and over again. You get a call from O'Reilly and they say, we need to update that book. And you're like, okay. And then you write a new TOC and then you write.
Actually, yeah. I'm really tickled by this conversation because both of your books, the CSS Cookbook and the CSS Missing Manual, were so helpful for me when I was writing learning web design, because since I don't do that work every day, I was, you know, it's like I read the spec and I know it's in the spec, which is like more confusing than it's ever been. But then it's like, okay, but I know I'm missing the, like, what am I missing? Well, it's a practical. Then I read everything I can read, and your books are really, really useful. So thank you guys.
You're welcome. Yes, yeah. I totally agree. Books are super useful, much better than Googling things, I think.
Yeah. So the learning web design is like a whole web design class, very, very beginner level class in a book. So you can learn, if you start knowing absolutely nothing, like I start dissecting a URL and talking about the difference between a server and a browser, then we build our way up through, you know, writing HTML, and by the end you're doing multi-column CSS layouts and little responsive project in there, and all the ins and outs of creating graphics. And this time I have JavaScript chapters in that book written by Wilto, also known as Matt Marquis
in
Boston. Yeah, so he wrote my JavaScript chapters, which was a blast to work with him on that. And it sounds just like him talking. So I think that's a
say no more, man.
Seriously. You have like a lot
so
of
the
little...
book is much better for his time and attention on it. We had a great time.
Yeah. Is there a little
now he's like, you know, internet hero. So I'm honored to have him in there.
That's great. Did you have to edit out any of his language?
he went easy, but there are some like excellent Wiltoisms in there I love.
Awesome. That's great. So you've been writing, you wrote, I think your first book was like 96. So you have sort of...
94.
Wow.
Yeah. So I wrote, actually I wrote four titles. That book was only out for one edition. It was called Designing for the Web. Uh-huh. And I still have a copy, and it is so hilariously flawed. here's one little example. I wanted to write it from a designer's perspective. So obviously, you know, there's just the inherent flaws of using HTML elements for presentation uses. But, you know, I asked, when I was first starting making graphics for GNN, I asked someone at O'Reilly, someone like technically oriented person, like, what's the resolution? Like, what resolution should I use? And they said, well, Macs are 72 and PCs are 96. So I don't know, make them 88. So not only are all my specs like, make your graphics 88 DPI. And, I put that in the book too.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a nice, it's been out of print for, you know, ages, which is because by the time I wrote the first edition of Learning Web Design, I had things straightened out, but oh my gosh, it's, you know, I just wrote what I knew, which apparently wasn't very much.
Well, it was more than other people knew.
Well, there are no other books to read to like check it out. Right. It was one of the first books, my book and, Linda Weinman's book was out right around the same time. Yeah, so her first edition came out just a few weeks before Designing for the Web. But thankfully, that book, you know, is no longer available. And every now, but it's super quaint. Like, I love looking at it.
Oh yeah, I love Lynn Wyman's deconstructing web graphics.
I still have that. I keep that just as a relic of like where we've been.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So. Some books I can't part with.
Yeah, it's a classic.
So. Yeah, some of these classic old web books.
Totally. Well, you know, there were so many beautiful web books. You know, full color books. You know, with great, you know, design and stuff that came out at that time too, that are worth holding on to just because they look so great, especially in a retro kind of 1996 web design way.
Yep.
Yeah. Like, I talked to, I was having one of the few times I was able to talk to Lynn Wyman during the 1990s was, we're talking about web books and everything like that. And she was working on another book and she said, like, she was talking to a friend and she said, I finally realized what we're doing with these books. And it's like, well, what's that? We're writing history books. We're writing about the state of the web in this moment in time, and that time is going to be quickly going away. And so it's like we're writing these like nice tomes for these, just history. So and I thought like, oh, that's kind of depressing, but it does give you a feel for it. Like, cause I like looking back at Linda's old books and stuff like that. So, and Bruce's artwork in it. So they're awesome stuff in there. So, but and talk about learning web design, and you talked about like the new, you had a JavaScript chapter and stuff like that. Like what was the new stuff that you put into this new edition that you liked or you felt like was like, oh, finally we have XYZ?
Well, that book got a little long in the tooth from the third edition to the fourth. So the third edition came out before the iPhone. So there was three paragraphs about mobile web, and it was all, you know, like WAP stuff.
Right.
And like this little tiny web, you know, list view in a old Nokia window or something. So the entire mobile mindset had to be added in there. You know, just like at every turn, you know, in the chapter about adding links, I just changed if someone clicks or taps a link, you know, just changing sort of a general like approach to everything. But then all of HTML5 had to go in there, and all of all of CSS3 had to go in there. Oh. The new JavaScript chapters were in there. And then I was just racing. In the course of writing that book, we got a Retina iPhone. And then, so I wrote up about, you know, Retina iPhones, and then a Retina iPad came out. So I had to go back, rewrite that because there's, you know, like, well, now there's a tablet and here are all the limitations and here's what's going on with, you know, JPEG limits. And then there was some sentence in there, like, I'm sure that, you know, this is the trend in the, you know, desktops and laptops that in Retina displays won't be far behind. By the time the manuscript was going to the production, then we had the Retina, you know, MacBook Pros and it was like, just, I had to rewrite that chapter so many times because technology was changing that fast. But it's an extremely hard time to write a book, you know, a history book on this stuff. The best I could do is like, here are the problems we're solving. Here's some of the thoughts on it. Here are some resources, some places to go to find out what the latest thinking is.
Right.
And here's what, you know, I always try to put everything in context, you know, especially in that book, it's the whys of doing, you know, why you do something and why it's important. So, you know, just try to give people arm them with good resources to follow the latest saga because, you know, stuff was going on with responsive images still is. Mm-hmm. It was a very hard time with all the mobile stuff changing weekly to write that book.
I mean, it's interesting. It is hard to write books about these evolving technologies now because it seems like the pace of innovation is so rapid, and it may really be affecting, you know, us as authors in terms of what is going to be the medium that we're going to use in the future to help communicate stuff. I mean, for example, on the software side, I mean, now Adobe has their subscription model and they are going to be, you know, they release updates with new features constantly that are not even part of, you know, not CSS 7, it's still CSS 6, but we got a new thing we're uploading. And so Photoshop has new features and Dreamweaver has new features. And so as an author, it's kind of daunting to think about how to are challenging to think about how to explain those things. What is, are books the proper medium, or is there something else? What do you think about that?
Well, that you're reminding me of trying to keep up with HTML as well, you know, because we don't have these, you know, there's the W3C stick in the ground. Okay, this is what HTML5 is, but there's kind of 5.1, and then there's extended, and people are just making, it seems like my perspective is people are just making up elements like every week. It's like, oh, now there's like, well, maybe we could use a main element. You know, it's like, okay, I would use that. But it's just, it's moving so fast. And then there's that compete, you know, there's the WG, you know, living spec. Mm-hmm. That stuff is always being put in there, and whether it's supported, and you can't, it's really hard. I'm going to be updating my Pocket Ref to the 5th edition really soon. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what do you put in there? How, you know, is it just the supported stuff? Is it everything they're documenting? It's going to be hard to draw a line and to keep up with it. Yeah, because we're not getting these solid releases that you can like, okay, here's our stopping point. It's just so fluid now. I do have a little... I turned my Pocket Ref into an app, an iPhone app, and which I think is actually makes much more sense for using that type of reference information than a linear page flip experience. Yeah. It's so nice to be able to filter it out. Like, oh, I want just, you know, XHTML, or I want, you know, HTML4. I want only 5. I want everything. You know, you can like filter, you can search, you can bookmark. It's just a better way to use that information. And it's really nice to use on an iPad too. But that's nice because you can just keep updating, and you don't have these big additions and big print runs. So I like that. It's much more fluid. And O'Reilly, it wasn't mentioned at the beginning of the show, but I actually work for O'Reilly now as their digital product designer.
Oh, really?
And yep, I'm an employee again. I took, you know, 16 years off, but I'm back.
Great. Good for you.
And, you know, they're really looking at all sorts of ways to keep up with the pace of things, you know, like publishing platforms that allow you to make live, you know, keep things up to date. Things, we're not getting big, not every book gets big published, you know, print runs. You know, you might be printing on demand for some titles, and you might be only electronic with other titles. So you can keep them as live as you would a web page. It's causing, you know, an old timer like me, like some like culture shifts. It's like, oh, okay. Like I can just change this anytime and then the book is updated. You know, but that's going to be the reality of trying to keep up with it, with the technology.
Definitely.
Like, yes.
Yeah, totally. Because I think I'm working on it with O'Reilly on a project, and it's just like, yeah, we're going to just, and it's going to be awesome because we get to finally dump Word. Actually, we're going to get using text files to write a book, and so
it's you are
like, yeah, it's like I think it's called ASCII doc.
ASCII doc, yep.
Yeah, and so it was like we're just bypassing Word, which is like the major headache I think I've had with writing books and stuff like that. So and just because it's just crazy as we all knew,
Well, Jennifer, maybe you could tell us a little bit about that, your new job. That sounds really interesting. I didn't know you were doing that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I started in 2010. I worked on turning that book into the app. And we did it in HTML and used PhoneGap to package it up to make an app out of it. So, you know, I was able to, you know, I handled all the content, but I also wrote the HTML and I did all the style sheets to design it. It was really weird. Like my world's colliding. I came from a book background and then I learned all the HTML stuff. And now with EPUB, you know, we're doing books using web technologies. So it's really been fascinating watching everything, you know, like my whole career, just like all like roll up in a big, like Katamari ball. You know? So 2010, I spent the year making this app and really learning a lot, you know, about making apps and, you know, reading the Apple HIG and just getting into that whole space. And then, so I was really, you know, working pretty constantly with Simon St. Laurent, who is also my editor for my books. Mm-hmm. And we collaborated. He handled like the JavaScript and the database end of the app that is beyond my skill set. But during the course of that, I was very, you know, involved with O'Reilly. And Edie said, we've got more of these things coming along. I think you'd be just the right person to be the designer for it. So I got brushed up on my interaction design and my user experience design and started doing, working on their app product.
So what are some of the titles?
Well, there are many that I worked on that haven't been released yet, and some that I was just sort of worked on the interaction stuff and we handed off. But we do apps for every one of our conferences. So we've been working with a team called Zomo up in mm-hmm. Vancouver on those. But I did lots of wireframing for those. Oh, cool. And we have a PHP, no PHP? No, PMP. Sorry, uh-huh. That's a totally different thing. quiz app that is, we're waiting for the content to be updated before that comes out. And we're working on a really cool thing now, a get-to-know series where you get to know a topic. It's going to be an iPad app. The mm-hmm. first topic is Hadoop, which is a big, vast topic. So we're mm-hmm. trying to like break it down into a taxonomy, like where you can explore one arm, like what, you know, and sort of go off in this fractal exploration of all the topics. And then there are live links to web pages where you know if you want to do a deep dive into the information. But it's just a new way of taking a topic and treating it. It's like, let's break it down into like categories so you can really just like pick and choose and explore particular categories and do it in a way that's, you know, when you have time, that's efficient and just get up to speed on a topic, you know, especially, you know, I guess people in CIO positions like hear about, you know, big data and hear about things like Hadoop mm-hmm, and just need to right. be brought up to speed. So it's a pretty cool interface, and it's been a lot of fun to work on, but that's not out yet. So
what's the name of that series that you're?
Get to Know.
Get to Know. Cool.
Yeah, but that's it has a number two.
Get to Know.
Yeah, Get to Know.
So do you see that kind of as a good model for the evolution of technical writing? Is now we'll move to apps, we'll move to, you know, rapid updates, that kind of thing?
I am really much more aligned with like open HTML, you know, open mm-hmm. technologies, mm-hmm. instead of making specific, you know, iPhone apps or iPad uh-huh. apps. I really like to keep it as open as possible. So
you mean like EPUB type thing?
Or, you know, just using, you know, doing web apps as opposed to native mm-hmm. For the types of information that we publish, you know, just trying to hit, you don't want to just limit yourself to one device
right.
or
sure.
even, you know, ecosystem. So mm-hmm. You just have, you know, instead of redoing it 20 different times, it's just nice to use the web technology. So, I think we're still experimenting with publishing to apps. You know, I do really love. What I like is that, you know, the reference information, there are just better ways to get to it than linearly, you know, in page after page after page. Mm-hmm. So sure. I like playing around with that long form content and finding other ways to get into it that make more sense. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see that turned into, you know, just an HTML5 app or some way that we can get onto every device instead of just iPhones and iPads. So, and I know that, you know, O'Reilly's all over the web technologies. In every, you know, for doing books
right.
and, you know, you can just push a button and it goes to the printer and it goes to an EPUB and it goes to Mobi format and it goes to a web page, you know, like you can just take this single marked up document and do so many things with it. And that, I think that's where it's at, rather than making native
mm-hmm. yeah.
little native one-off, you know, single purpose things.
Right. What do you use for EPUB? Do you actually, have you made EPUBs?
I haven't done that yet. No, I'm just starting to look under the hood mm-hmm. of those. So that's in my need to learn pile.
Your long list.
With about yeah, it's more than a pile. It's like a mountain. It's so hard to keep up with.
Well, the cool part is like, you know, if you actually store your, you know, text in the text file, and then you can just export to HTML and mm-hmm. EPUB and so on. So it's really like, I guess it's what. You know, XML was supposed to be pretty much so.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And you know what? And the reality is that people are like device shifting. It's like, I'll start this here, I'll finish it there. And mm-hmm. And the web technologies allow you to do that. So yeah. I think, you know, yeah. I think it just has a lot. I think it has legs in the way that like building little native apps might not. Unless you want to develop it for every platform, which, as everyone knows, is really expensive and hard to maintain.
But would you say that for doing products for O'Reilly, that working on the open web technologies is the best? But I was having a conversation with someone recently, and they're like, pretty much is like, you know, just saying like dissing, you know, the open web apps really, and said just like native apps is where it's at, pretty much, and just saying like people want to have kind of that native app experience, and you know, and kind of like hinted at like, you know, Facebook dropping HTML5 to go to you know, the native app for their version. Talk about Instagram versus the new Flickr version of it. So, I mean, I think that's with photos. So you have to have access to the camera. So I can see where like, you know, there's some issues where like you definitely would want to have a native app.
Yeah. There are definitely some things that need to be, but But yeah, I hear people say that like, no, it's all going to be apps, but I really like the things that Scott Jensen has to say, which is, you know, like, this is not going to scale. We are not going to have an app for every store we walk in, an app for every book we want to read, an app for, you know, every little purpose. Because the friction of like managing them and access, finding the thing you need when you need it, even remembering that you have it, you know. Yeah, exactly. And I'm pretty moderate when it comes to like app collection, and I have so much stuff on there I downloaded, used once, and never used again.
Right.
I've heard apps referred to as trinkets, and every now, you know, there's some things that you use that I use all the time, and they're on the front, you know, homepage of my iPhone. But there's so much stuff that you buy it, use it once, and it's gone. I mean, but I guess people are making money from those trinkets like they make money on real world trinkets that are disposable too. But I don't see how it can scale. Like, it's just too much effort and too fragmented.
Right. Well, I definitely see that because I love the trinkets analogy because the whole new idea of like having TV channels be apps now just scares me, because there's like how many channels are on a cable TV.
Right. You can have a separate app for everyone.
Yes. So that's why I like Netflix. I mean, I think the Netflix just, you know, is disruptive to our normal TV, or what we think about normal TV is awesome. And that, you know, you're not bounded by brand of the TV, of the, you know, TV network. You just want the show that they did that was really good, or what you want to go back and through it. So.
Well, and that comes back to what you were talking about, Jennifer, with device switching. Like, two of my favorite apps are, or two of my favorite, I don't know, technologies. Netflix is one of them, because I can be watching on my desktop computer, then I can switch to an iPad, then I can switch to a phone, and I'm watching, I can watch the same movie or the same TV show, just pick it up at the same point on any of those devices at any time. That and like Evernote. I don't know if you guys use Evernote, but
I love Evernote.
You know, it's a note collecting app, and it's in the cloud, and so I have it on my phone, I have it on my iPad, I have it on my computer, you know, both my desktop and my laptop. It's all synced, so whenever I just open it up, all of my notes are there. Everything I've ever taken any information about, I can get it on any of these devices, and even on somebody else's device, because all I'd have to do is log in and there are my notes. And I love the flexibility of just picking up anything I have at hand and being able to access my information without even thinking about it.
Yeah. And, you know, the reality is we're going to be carrying around our computers all the time.
Yeah.
So that opens up a lot of new behaviors.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just thinking the other day, it was like how people who never say that they're computer people or don't know how to use a computer, but they have like iPhone in their pocket, you know, just walking around. So it's kind of crazy. But, and what that means to society as a whole. So we have people who are just can use computers whenever they want to and connect all over the place. So,
How many people who that's their only connection to the internet, they don't have a computer at home and they don't have Wi-Fi at home, but that is their connection to the internet, which is, you know, more reason why every website needs to work on a mobile, you know, work in small scale.
I just read this thing about Netflix talking about, you know, the friction of having to, you know, keep up with multiple devices. They apparently they just did launched released a video on this. They have to encode each video 1,000 times.
Wow!
So they have 1,000 versions of each video to work with Roku and, you know, all of the, you know, Wii and all the devices that can access Netflix. So I mean, only a company like Netflix can afford to do something like that. Yep. You know.
Yeah, 1,000 different. I think that's all they track 1,000 and then they encode it 120 different ways to hit all those different environments. Okay. And yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah.
So we'll wait to see if it pulls itself together or continues to fragment infinitely.
Right. So speaking of mobile, like you're working on a mobile design conference.
Why, yes, I am, Christopher.
Yes, awesome.
Hear about it.
Sure. It's called Artifact Conference, and it's a conference for designers who need to like change their tools and their methods and their processes to adapt to a multi-device world. And we're going to look at like new workflows that, you know, the responsive design, you know, one response or one way to deal with all the devices is to design, you know, responsively. But that changes your workflow when you know that your website is going to be on everything from 240 pixels to 2400 pixels wide. You know, the sort of crux of it is that, you know, static Photoshop comps just aren't going to cut it anymore. So the big question for me is like, well, if not Photoshop comps, then what? You know, so we're going to answer in the conference like the what part and look at all different approaches to, you know, to workflow, to new deliverables like style guides and, you know, style guides that are specifically geared towards digital products and things that have behaviors and interactions. And, looking and how you manage your clients' expectations, because we're learning, but we need to keep our clients and the stakeholders and projects up to speed too. So that's a really big part of it. And I think we're going to have a great conversation around that. Designing for touch, learning Git and GitHub, because, you know, code is part of the designer's toolbox now. It's we need to design in a native habitat, you know, design with the code and try it out on all these different devices. So if we're going to be using code, we need to, you know, have our code play nice with others and learn, you know, tools like Git for version control. Those are the things that are coming off the top of my head. Jen Simmons will be there teaching sort of like a design approach beyond just moving boxes from the sidebar to the bottom. You know, like maybe you just don't move it wholesale. Maybe there are different ways, a little more, you know, subtle ways of finessing and thinking about your design and what content goes where and navigation. So just addressing all these different issues that are new. And, you know, it feels a lot like when I was learning the web for the first time back in 93, 94. Like we were trying things. Our tools weren't quite right. We had all these little... Yep. weird add-ons and little like utilities for doing things. And I feel like we're kind of in that position now where the technology has gotten ahead of our systems and our tools. So we have all these stopgap measures, but then also, you know, I'm starting to see like something's emerging, you know, and that's what I want to talk about in the conference. So I was seeing all these great ideas and I just put it out there on Twitter. Like, I want this conference. Who's in? And then someone, Christopher, answered my call.
I said, like, hey, that's an awesome idea. We should talk about that.
And that's how it was born, was, you know, you can find anything on Twitter, like even conference organizers.
So when's the conference?
It's going to be in Austin, Texas, May 13th and 14th and 15th of next year. There is a mailing list to sign up to get more information as it becomes available, and that's at artifactconf.com. We also have a Twitter handle that's not too active quite yet, but as soon as we start getting people signed up and get our program published, then we'll have a lot more to say. And there, that's artifactconf as well on Twitter. Yeah. But yeah, things are coming along. We're starting to get our speakers in and places lined up, and it's very exciting. I think it's going to be, you know, I think it's going to be good. There are a lot of conferences right now, but and I go to a lot of them. I'm big into conferences, but I find there's, you know, a lot of high level like design thinking, and then there are a lot of development, you know, for developers, mobile conferences, you know, for people actually building the code. And they usually have a design track in there. But what I want is like for designers, like people who are like doing the creative process, the design process, the problem solving process, and just like tons of takeaways. Like, you know, don't tell me this is what you're doing. Like, show me how to do it. Like, I don't have time in my, you know, in my workload to get up to speed with all of this. Like, it's just too much. So if I can shorten people's learning curve by spending an hour just doing a little show and tell, like, oh, here's what I thought, what did I mean? And here's how you would open a responsive framework and use it as a, to do a quick prototype, you know? So if someone can show me in an hour, it would be such, you know, so much better than trying to learn it on the web myself. I would never get around to it. So hopefully if, like, it's basically I'm lining up all the classes. I'm thinking almost more like classes than presentations, but I'm lining up all these presentations that I need to learn personally. Mm-hmm. And I figure, well, if I need to learn it, probably other people do too. Right. So it's very self-centered. like, this is the stuff, like, I need to learn Git. I don't know Git. It confuses me. GitHub, I look at the pages. I'm like, I don't know what I'm allowed to touch here. Like, I want someone just to sort that out for me. Mm-hmm. Show me in an hour and a half. And then I can go with that, like, you know, armed with that information and learn the rest myself or use it if it makes sense for my workflow or don't use it, but at least I know, you know, so yeah, I'm very excited about it.
Right. Yeah. I'm excited too. I mean, like you talked about it on Twitter and we've been talking about it for a while now is this, cause we do the InControl conference, which is, which we work with local AIGA chapters. So we've worked with AIGA Cincinnati, AIGA Orlando and AIGA Honolulu and AIGA, if no one knows about it, it's a national chapter for designers, and it has a really strong print background, but the web and interactive is not, you know, not so great, you know, pretty much. And so we kind of work with on a local level, trying to bring in these great speakers like Dave to come and share their knowledge. And so when you mentioned this conference, I was like, oh yeah, this is exactly like as a designer, we, you know, mobile is not going to go anywhere. So
yeah.
I felt like it was a natural fit for us to work together on that project. So I'm really stoked. I'm really happy to actually work on a conference, a face-to-face conference in Austin, Texas, after being here for several years now. So it's awesome.
And I'm always happy to have an excuse to go to Austin. So yeah. I'm psyched too.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. I got to ask you about this thing. I just Googled a little bit about you. Cooking with rock stars.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Was that you?
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit about that one?
Sure.
yeah, I was watching the Dresden Doll one just before the show. So
it was my video podcast. I started in 2002, which was actually before YouTube and before there was any way to actually do video podcasts. I had to sort of roll my own. But it just combined my two passions for indie rock music and foodie stuff, cooking. So originally had an idea to do like a full-blown show with like crafting and technology and everything, but it's like, no, we'll just stick to rock stars and food, like the intersection of that. So I just started interviewing people and it like just took like my little camcorder, stood on street corners talking to, you know, like Jenny Lewis from Rilo Kiley. And I had, in the beginning, it was just me and my little Sony camcorder. Uh-huh. We'd be in broom closets trying to find a quiet, bright place at a club at soundcheck time is kind of a challenge. So we'd be in parking lots, broom closets, stairwells. It was really fun, though. It was just so much fun. But I got Jack Black as a friend of my brother's, and I got him for the show. Yeah, his recipe was the Dorito burrito.
Oh, nice.
He's always a class. And no, I just had a blast doing that.
So how did you connect with these people? Did you just show up or did you
all different ways. Some of them were friends of mine. Some of them, like Jack, my brother, has worked with Jack a lot. So he was just over at my brother's house and we did it. So there's some, you know, some indie rockers you can just walk up and say, hey, I love your project. I've got this project. Want to be on my project? And they're like, yeah, cool. And then some people, or I would, you know, approach them in person and say, the next time you're in town, I'd love to do this. can I have like the name of your people? So I'd sort of make a personal connection, but then go through the proper channels. And then for bigger acts like Supergrass, I would just go through the, you know, PR channels. Mm-hmm. And it's offbeat enough that people said yes. You know, it's like, it was, you know, they were like Ben Gibbard from Death Cab is like, this is the most awesome interview because I don't have to tell you how I got my band name or where we recorded it. He's like, we're just going to talk about like Toast.
This is awesome. You have Robin Hitchcock, two parts. Is it the same recipe or did he do two recipes?
He, his recipe was food pie. Yeah.
Pie, that's food.
That's so awesome. That was super fun. By the end, we were doing it in a limo, recording the show in a limo because it was like a little studio. You know, the broom closets weren't working for me. Going onto tour buses worked, but you have so much lighting and mics and stuff to set up that you really felt like you were imposing on their personal space. Like you're going into their home and just like never leaving. So my editor and cameraman, James Holland, we were walking down the street and this limo went by and he's like, we should do the show in one of those. Totally. And then we're like, ha ha ha, wait, that could actually work. So I'd rent the limo. We'd get it all set up with the lighting, with the mic, you know, check all the mics, get the cameras set up. Then just after sound check, bring the rock stars out, pour them some champagne, have a lovely little chat. Sometimes I'd bring hors d'oeuvres and then we'd send them back. You know, they'd go do their thing and we could take our time cleaning up, you know, and putting everything away without imposing. And it was super fun.
That's great.
But yeah, and I'd love to get that going again.
That's you when you, yeah, it's ended.
It ended. Yeah. 2008 was when I just realized I couldn't be spending money on limos. I needed to have a project that made money instead of cost so much money every episode. So I ended up shifting gears. I don't know, wrote a book or something. I don't know what I ended up doing instead. But super fun project. I would love to get it going again. It's one of those things like the site needs a whole redesign because it's pretty stale. The video formats don't make sense for today, and I just don't have the bandwidth to go back and redo it. So if anybody out there would like to do a really simple, minimal, little responsive page template for Cooking with Rockstars so I could put up some new stuff.
Is it running on WordPress or something like that? Or
It's on Drupal.
Drupal, uh-huh.
Yeah. So yeah, if anybody, but I'm not entirely wedded to that. I just want something totally stripped down, just the videos, get rid of all that extra stuff, just to get it out there and have it work on everything. Come reach me at Genville on Twitter.
This is great. Yeah, I love it.
Awesome. Yeah,
I think so. You host all the videos on Blip?
Yes, I was using Blip for all the videos.
Cool.
They were great to work with.
So there you go, world. Something you didn't know. I didn't know about Jennifer Robbins. That's amazing.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
And then my web intersection with the music world is I used to be Ringo Starr's website designer.
Oh, get out. Really?
Yeah, we maintained Ringo's. We designed and maintained Ringo's website for about 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Not recently, but it's since turned into more of a marketing site. But he had one of the first video blogs because he doesn't like to type.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But he would just like set up his camera wherever he was touring around the world or at his home and, you know, in England and just do a little chat out to his fans and put, you know, photos up. But mostly he'd just make these quick little videos to talk to people and tell them what he was up to. And we rigged up this little thing. My husband, Jeff Robbins, made a little icon of his head to put on. And so all Ringo had to do was drag the file onto the icon of Jeff's face and it would run an Apple script that would upload it to the server and send us like do all sorts of stuff in the background. It was really fun. And then also we had things like, you know, Ringo Starr calling our house and sounding just like Ringo Starr. That was another connection through my brother. And my brother is Liam Lynch. He does all sorts of music and video production and movie writing and production and directing. He's a cool dude.
Yeah,
you can Google some Liam Lynch. He was just on Nerdist. There's a good podcast of him on Nerdist.
I don't know where we could take the interview from here. Yeah. I think we hit Ringo Starr, and it's all going to be a letdown at this point. So, usually we ask our guests, what are you most passionate about now, technology or career or anything like that, and what are you interested in now?
I'm interested in getting everybody up to speed with this new mobile thing. I'm giving talks on the new responsive workflow, and I like being in the position of, in the early 90s, I was teaching print designers how to do web, and now I feel like there's another opportunity to help people adapt to the needs of multi-device. So that's sort of where my professional mojo is happening right now.
Excellent. Where can people find you on the web and follow you and all that stuff?
I have a creaky personal site that is neglected and needs a responsive makeover, genville.com. That's my personal home with links to other things. And I'm on the Twitter quite a lot at Genville there as well.
Excellent. Cool. Well, thanks so much. It was a real pleasure to meet you and to talk to you and learn about all the many things that you've done.
Well, thanks. I had so much fun. This was great.
Our thanks to Jennifer Robbins for joining us on Non-Breaking Space. As always, check out the show notes at nonbreakingspace.tv for all links and sites discussed during the episode. We're also on the iTunes podcast listing, and we'd really appreciate if you subscribe and left a rating or review. Help spread the word about the show. We've been experimenting with live streaming our recording, so be sure to follow us on Twitter at NBSPTV for future recording dates and times. And be sure to watch for the next episode of Non-Breaking Space to hear Carl Smith tell Gene Crawford,
I think I just gained a little respect for you, sir.